The Turkish day is divided into four periods, which are longer or shorter according to the time of year. But at night, there is nothing to mark the time. Our guides, as I have said, misled by the brightness of the moon, would give the signal for packing up long before sunrise. We would then hastily get up, so that we might not be late or be blamed for any untoward incident that might occur. Our baggage would be collected, my bed and the tents hurled into the carriage, our horses harnessed, and we ourselves girt up and ready, awaiting the signal for departure. Meanwhile, the Turks, having realized their mistake, had returned to their beds and their slumbers. I dealt with this annoyance by forbidding the Turks to disturb me in future, and undertaking to wake the party at the proper time, if they would warn me overnight of the hour at which we must start. I explained to them that I had clocks which never failed me, and would arrange matters, taking the responsibility of letting them sleep on. They could, I said, safely trust me to get up. They assented, but were still not quite at their ease. They arrived in the early morning, and waking my valet, begged him to go and ask me what the fingers of my timepiece said. He did this, and then indicated, as best he could, whether a long or short time remained before the sun would rise. When they had tested us once or twice, and found that they were not deceived, they relied on us henceforward, and expressed their admiration of the trustworthiness of our clocks. Thus we could enjoy our sleep undisturbed by their clamour. In a later letter, written in 1560, Busbeck noted, "No nation has shown less reluctance to adopt the useful inventions of others. For example, they have appropriated to their own use large and small cannons, and many other of our discoveries. They have, however, never been able to bring themselves to print books and set up public clocks. They hold that their scriptures, that is, their sacred books, would no longer be scriptures if they were printed. And if they established public clocks, they think that the authority of their muezzins and their ancient rites would suffer diminution." Another European traveller, Jean Chardin, who visited Persia in 1674, is quoted in 1683 by the English diarist John Evelyn as saying that the Persians had neither clocks nor watches. Busbeck's characterization of Turkish and more generally of the Middle Eastern attitudes to the measurement of time and space was no doubt exaggerated, but not entirely false. A characteristic noticed by many travellers was the extreme variability of the weights and measures in common use. The English Arabist, Edward William Lane, who spent a good deal of time in Egypt between 1833 and 1835, and wrote extensively on the country and its people, noted, "Of the measures and weights used in Egypt, I am not able to give an exact account, for, after diligent search, I have not succeeded in finding any two specimens of the same denomination perfectly agreeing with each other, and generally the difference has been very considerable." There was, indeed, wide variation. The ratl, the commonest measure of weight in the marketplace, roughly the equivalent of the European pound, could differ considerably according to the commodity that was being weighed, and the place where this was done. The same applied to measures of capacity. To confuse matters further, the same names were used with different values. Similar difficulties arise in dealing with the linear measurements used to indicate length and distance. Medieval Islam inherited a considerable body of scientific knowledge from classical antiquity and, more remotely, from the ancient civilizations of the Middle East. To this, they added new knowledge achieved by their own experiments and researches, notably in cartography, geography, geometry, and astronomy. The last named, in particular, involved delicate and precise calculations of both time and space. But all this seems to have had little effect on the everyday calculation of time and distance, for practical purposes, for which simpler and more basic methods were used. Linear measurements were basically of three categories. The first, on a small scale, was commercial and practical in purpose, for measuring cloth and similar commodities, and in building. It was normally expressed in terms of parts of the human body: the finger, the fist, the span, the cubit or ell, the forearm, the fathom, i.e., the distance from fingertip to fingertip of outstretched arms. A second use of linear measurement, requiring somewhat larger units, was to define enclosed areas. Such measures were required for cadastral and fiscal purposes, and to delimit land held in freehold or, more commonly, under some kind of grant. For the collection of taxes and the allocation of responsibility, somewhat more precise measures were needed than for either trade or travel. Measures in use in earlier times were based mainly on agriculture, some on the amount of land that could be sown with a given quantity of seed, others, more commonly, on the area that could be ploughed in a given period of time. The same use of time spent to indicate distance covered dominates the discussion of what one might call geographic distance. Geographers and cartographers had their systems, mostly derived from classical antiquity, but these were too arcane and too uncertain for most practical purposes. In the literature of travel, in the histories, in public and private correspondence, distance between places is almost invariably measured in terms of time, the basic units being the hour and the day. But days vary in length according to season. The hour, an arbitrary man-made division, has different meanings, and the distance travelled in even a fixed hour or day will be affected, indeed determined, by the terrain and the traveller. Measures of distance for travel drew on the human body in movement. Thus the old Persian farsakh, which appears in Greek as parasang, was defined as the distance a man could cover on foot in an hour, while the Arab marhala, Turkish konak, was the distance a traveller could cover in a day. In the former Byzantine provinces, the Muslim government for a while retained the Roman mile, in Arabic called mil. In these, too, there was an attempt to establish relationship. The farsakh was said to be 3 miles, the mile 100 fathoms. The habit of measuring distances in time and motion has survived to the present day. It is not unusual, if one asks a peasant how far it is to the next village, to be told 1 cigarette, meaning that if you light a cigarette now, by the time you finish it, you will be in the village. Busbeck was mistaken in thinking that there were no milestones. The earliest Islamic milestones are dated 86 AH, 705 in the Common Era, and were erected by the Caliph Abd al-Malik in the district of Jerusalem. Two of them point to Jerusalem, one at 7 miles, the other at 8 miles from the city. The other two point to Damascus at 107 and 109 miles. These represent a relic of the past, and the use of miles and of milestones had in general little impact in the Islamic Middle East. The word mile, Arabic mil, remained in use but was, so to speak, assimilated. Arabic lexicographers define it as the distance to which the eye can reach along land. Some assess this at 3,000 cubits, others at 4,000 cubits. Using different cubits, they agree that its extent is 96,000 fingers. Even if Busbeck was technically in error, his exasperation is understandable. The situation regarding the measurement of time is not much better. The day, the month, and the year are, of course, fixed by nature, though it may be noted in passing that for Muslims, as for Jews, the day begins at sunset, and the evening and the morning were the first day. Genesis 1:5. For measuring anything less than a day or more than a year, human ingenuity provided answers. At one end, the clock to divide the day, at the other, the calendar to count the years. The subdivisions of the day are thus conventional, and considerable differences arise. The principal subdivision of the day, the hour, Arab sa'a, Aramaic sha'ta, Hebrew sha'a, was already known in antiquity. In the Hebrew Bible, the word only occurs 5 times, all of them in the book of Daniel, that is to say, after the Babylonian captivity, when the Jews came under the influence of Babylonian culture. Of the 5, 4, chapter 3, verses 6 and 15, chapter 4, verse 30, chapter 5, verse 5, all refer to something happening at the same moment as something else. Only in one occurrence, Daniel 4:16, does the word appear to indicate a unit of time. In Talmudic literature, the word is already extensively used to mean one of a sequence of numbered subdivisions of the day or of the night, but how many and of what length is not always clear. In the Quran, the word sa' occurs no less than 47 times, 33 of them referring to the last hour, and therefore retaining the earlier meaning of a moment, or instant. At some unspecified but almost certainly early date, the Arabs adopted the notion that the day was divided into 24 hours. These hours were of two kinds: temporal, i.e., varying according to the season, or fixed and equal. In a civilization comparatively close to the equator, the temporal discrepancies were less important than in the remoter lands of Europe. By Ottoman times, a compromise was in use, whereby the day was divided into 24 equal hours, but the reckoning, in accordance with old tradition, started at sunset. This meant that, in principle, clocks had to be reset every day. This arrangement is sometimes referred to by travelers as Turkish time or Arab time. The two systems of reckoning time remained in use to the present day, but the increasingly general adoption of clocks and watches is gradually eliminating the variable clock. Apart from the natural, usually observable demarcation of the day by dawn, noon, and sunset, one other subdivision was of crucial importance for Muslims, and that was the fixing of the times of prayer. In the same way, one of the most basic purposes of the geographical sciences was to determine the direction of prayer, i.e., of Mecca. This was especially important in newly Islamized countries, where there was no established tradition. The five daily prayers toward Mecca are one of the basic religious obligations of every Muslim. Communal prayer takes place once a week, on Friday. On the other days, the individual prays, if necessary, alone, wherever he may be. The time is stated as a band rather than a moment, and is determined by observation. The times of the five prayers are 1. The pre-dawn prayer, before the sun appears. 2. The noon prayer, where the sun passes the zenith. 3. The afternoon prayer, when the shadows cast by objects are equal to their height. 4. The sunset prayer, after the sun has disappeared beneath the horizon. And 5. The evening or night prayer, after the disappearance of the last light. The exact observation of these phenomena is therefore of paramount importance, and will obviously be much affected by regional and seasonal differences. From early times, Muslim scholars and scientists devoted considerable efforts to determining and tabulating the correct times and direction of prayer. At one level, this was done by simple observation, at another by the devising of instruments and the preparation of tables. Apart from prayer, there were few other activities that required even approximate timing. This was a society in which there were no parliaments, councils, or municipalities, and the conduct of public business required no kind of schedule. The nearest approach to a council, the Ottoman Imperial Divan, met 4 days a week, on Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. According to contemporary descriptions, it began its proceedings at daybreak and continued until about noon, when the petitioners and other outsiders withdrew and lunch was served to the members of the Divan, who then went on to discuss what business remained. In school and colleges, the teaching day was, of course, punctuated and regulated by the prayers. Travel for caravans or for individuals was again structured around the prayers and ultimately the three points of the day: sunrise, noon, and sunset. An important figure at the courts of some Middle Eastern rulers was the Munajjim, who combined the functions of astrologer and astronomer. In the first capacity, he was concerned with fixing astrological times. That is to say, he had to choose auspicious times for starting a new venture, a wedding, a military campaign, a journey, and the like. In his capacity as astronomer, he was responsible for keeping and, where necessary, correcting the astronomical tables and establishing some sort of relationship between astronomical and practical time. The use of devices to measure the passage of time was by no means new in the Middle East. The ancient Greeks used two devices for measuring time, the sundial and the water clock. Both of them were invented in the Middle East, the sundial, according to Herodotus, by the Babylonians, the water clock by the Egyptians. The sundial tells the time by the changing length and direction of the shadow, and varies, therefore, according to the season and the place. Greek mathematicians devised several ways of coping with these two problems. The sundial was, of course, useless between sunset and sunrise, or when the sun was hidden, and there was no remedy for that. The water clock, a place or a device where water leaks at a regular pace, had the advantage that it also worked in the dark, but it posed problems of care and maintenance. Here, too, the Greek mathematicians devoted considerable ingenuity in inventing automata to tell the time by water, some of them with musical accompaniment. Medieval Muslim scientists added some new, rather elaborate, devices of their own. Some of these even found their way to Europe, where they were treasured more as works of art than as objects for everyday use. The mechanical clock was a product of Europe, where it was first attested at the beginning of the 14th century. The spread of European clocks to the Middle East was a slow process. The Ottoman Sultan, Mehmed II, is alleged to have shown some interest. The same is said of Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent, to whom, in 1547, the French king sent a great clock made in Lyon, where there was a fountain which, in the space of 12 hours, drew the water that had been put there and was a masterpiece of high price. By the 16th century, European clocks and watches were widely used in the Middle East. They were found particularly useful in mosques to fix the times of the 5 daily prayers. Taqi al-Din, the creator of the Istanbul Observatory, even wrote a treatise on clocks operated by weights and springs. In the mid and late 17th centuries, there was a guild of clockmakers and watchmakers in Istanbul. They were, however, émigrés from Europe, not local, and by the end of the 17th century, they were no longer able to compete with imports from Europe, where manufacturers were designing special clocks and watches for the Middle Eastern market, and were steadily improving the quality of pendulum clocks and spring-driven watches, with which local clockmakers could not compete. Voltaire, in his correspondence, has some interesting references to watchmakers living on his estate at Ferny, who with his help exported their products to Turkey. During the 17th and 18th centuries, clocks figure with increasing frequency, first among the gifts presented by European embassies and companies to Middle Eastern monarchs and notables, and then as articles of commerce. Maintenance and repair of these unfamiliar devices were, of course, a problem, and all too often, when clocks, for one reason or another, ceased to function, they were neglected and abandoned. The practice arose of sending craftsmen, along with the gift of clocks, to demonstrate their use and to repair them when necessary. Some even established residence in Turkey and, to a much lesser extent, in Persia. In some of the commercial agreements and treaties between Europe and Middle Eastern governments, the European parties undertook to send clockmakers and watchmakers, as well as clocks and watches. In the 18th century, if not earlier, there were many clocks and watches in private possession, as is attested by the inventories of the estates of deceased persons. A tabulation of Western-made articles in these inventories in Istanbul puts clocks and watches in first place, almost double the number of pistols and muskets, which come second. Binoculars, telescopes, and eyeglasses come later in the list in much smaller quantities. By the 19th century, European clocks and watches were in general use, but all were in government or private possession. The practice of establishing public clocks in towers or other structures remained alien. A few are reported in some of the Balkan provinces of the Ottoman Empire, where most of the inhabitants were Christian, some of them indeed dating from before the Ottoman conquest, but these were local and without impact elsewhere. A public clock set up in the market of Isfahan, constructed by an Englishman by order of Shah Abbas, 1587 to 1629, was apparently of brief duration. It was not until the middle of the 19th century that the first public clock in Istanbul, perhaps indeed in any Islamic country, was installed in the grounds of the Dolmabahce Palace, and at about the same time, in 1854, a clock tower was built in the citadel of Cairo, equipped with a clock received some time earlier as a gift from the French king Louis Philippe to the Egyptian ruler Mohammed Ali Pasha. As always with a borrowed technology and its culture, there was a time lag in the measurement of time. This problem was aggravated by the general change in the Islamic world. Some centuries earlier, the Islamic Middle East had led the world in science and technology, including devices for measuring time. But Middle Eastern technology and science ceased to develop, precisely at the moment when Europe, and more specifically Western Europe, was advancing to new heights. The disparity was gradual, but progressive. By the late 18th century, watchmakers in Istanbul were able to produce clocks and watches of the type made in Europe in the early 17th century. In this, as in much else, they were unable to keep pace with the rapidly advancing West. The week, like the hour, is unrelated to natural phenomena. For Jews, Christians, and Muslims, it is defined by Scripture, and its concluding day of rest and/or public prayer is differently determined. Saturday for Jews, Sunday for Christians, Fridays for Muslims. Even the measurement of the passing of months and years still leaves some scope for religious regulation and human ingenuity. Already in antiquity, astronomers noted the discrepancy between the lunar and solar years, and devised a number of ways of bridging it, of which the best known is the leap year. For religious purposes, Islam, unlike Judaism and Christianity, established a purely lunar calendar, with the result that all the Islamic festivals rotate through the entire solar year three times a century. This calendar is reckoned from the beginning of the Arabian year, in which the Hijra, the migration of the Prophet from Mecca to Medina, took place. Being purely lunar, the Hijra calendar caused some practical difficulties in public administration, particularly at a time when taxation depended mainly on agriculture, which in turn is determined by the rotation of the seasons. Muslim governments, therefore, from early times, adopted a number of different solar calendars, which were used for administrative purposes, alongside the religious lunar calendar. Some were pre-Islamic, such as the solar calendars in use at the time of the conquest in Egypt and Iran. Others were post-Islamic. The Ottoman Maliye, or financial year, was a solar adaptation of the Muslim era, using Muslim dates with Eastern Christian months. Dating from 1790 of the Common Era, it remained in use almost until the end of the empire. A Persian compromise, combining the Muslim year with old Persian months, remains in use in Iran to the present day. In both of these, discrepancies inevitably arose between the true Muslim lunar reckoning and the adapted solar Muslim year. Thus, for example, the Young Turk Revolution of 1908 occurred in 1326 of the Hijra and 1324 of the Maliye era. The Iranian Revolution of 1979 in 1399 of the Hijra and 1358 of the Iranian solar calendar. Private and business correspondence, as far as one can ascertain, were dated according to the Muslim calendar, but fiscal records were kept according to one or more solar calendars. Until the 19th century, diplomatic documents carried Muslim lunar dates, but these sometimes show a curious imprecision. Ottoman royal letters and other missives indicate the year by number and the month by name. The day, however, is normally indicated as the first of the month, the last of the month, or the first, middle, or last decade of the month. With such difficulties, and their equivalents elsewhere, it is hardly surprising that the Christian calendar, in its Gregorian version, is now generally accepted for almost all public and governmental functions, by Muslims and Jews in the Middle East, and by non-Christians everywhere else in the world. The universalization of this era is symbolized by the replacement of AD and BC by CE, Common Era, and BCE in international usage. As well as time, Western influence also affected the measurement, perception, and use of space. The difference can be seen immediately in the contrast between European and Islamic art, notably in the artist's perception and use of perspective. In this respect, European influence can be discerned at an early date in Turkish and Persian painting, both miniature and mural. The perception of space was much affected by the introduction of two European devices for improving vision, reading glasses and telescopes. The first are attested as early as the 15th century and as far east as Iran, where the poet Jami, lamenting the infirmities of old age, remarks that his eyes were now useless. Unless with the aid of Frankish glasses, the two become four. Middle Eastern soldiers and officials were quick to appreciate the value of telescopes for military purposes, and later, in combination with other devices, for demarcation. This made it possible to introduce what was previously a purely European idea, that of a precisely demarcated frontier. Medieval states did not have frontiers in the modern sense. On land, as in time, there was no precise line of demarcation, but rather a zone, a band, or interval. This was sufficient for all practical purposes. Islamic laws regulating relations within and between states deal with people, not places. A ruler ruled as far as he could collect taxes and maintain order. When there were no taxes to collect, the precise boundary didn't matter. Deserts were regarded in much the same way as the sea. The notion of a frontier and the possibility of precise demarcation came from Europe, along with the idea that such demarcation was both possible and necessary. The Ottoman and Persian empires were in a state of intermittent conflict for some 400 years, but it was not until 1914 that, with the help of a joint Anglo-Russian commission of experts, they finally demarcated a frontier between them. That frontier still marks the western borders of Iran, with Turkey in the north, and with Iraq in the south, where it gave rise to some frontier disputes. Western perceptions and measurement of time and space also had an impact on art and music. We can see the influences of European art on the miniature at quite an early date, even as far east as Iran. One of the attractions of Western art, and particularly of Western portraiture, must surely have been the use of perspective, which made possible a degree of realism and accuracy unattainable in the stylized and rather formal art of the traditional miniature. Pictures of the Kaaba in Mecca, the holiest shrine of Islam, were widely disseminated in the Ottoman lands and elsewhere. There were, of course, schematic representations. Sometime in the early 18th century, a European artist, presumably having obtained one of these pictures, redrew it in the European style, that is, in perspective. It appears on a musical clock made in England for the Turkish market. In the late 18th and early 19th century, Western influence becomes very clear, both in the structure of buildings and in their interior decoration. By the 19th century, it is almost universal, to such a degree that the older artistic traditions were dying and being replaced by this new art from Europe. As the perception and measurement of space affected the visual arts, so too did the perception and measurement of time affect music, though to a much lesser extent. At first sight, this selective rejection of Western music in the general process of Westernization is the reverse of what one would expect. Verbal culture, after all, would appear to be the most difficult, since in all its forms it requires either knowledge of a foreign language or the mediation of a translator. Yet in many ways, it is precisely the literary and more generally verbal culture that has been the most accepted and the best assimilated. Even among non-verbal cultural influences, we find the same contrast between the visual, artistic and architectural influence, which on the whole has been very extensive, and the musical, which has been slow and limited. And in this we may perhaps discern an essential feature of Western civilization. A distinguishing characteristic of Western music is polyphony, by harmony or counterpoint. This begins in its simplest form with the choir, in which matched voices sing different notes in a planned sequence to produce a combined effect. Then comes the keyboard instrument, matching the 10 fingers of the 2 hands, following different routes in a common purpose, and finally, the musical ensemble, from duets and trios to the full orchestra. Different performers play together, from different scores, producing a result that is greater than the sum of its parts. With a little imagination, one may discern the same feature in other aspects of Western culture, in democratic politics and in team games, both of which require the cooperation in harmony, if not in unison, of different performers playing different parts in a common purpose. In parliamentary politics and team games, there is a further cooperation in conflict. Rival parties or teams striving to defeat their opponents, but nevertheless acting under an agreed set of rules and in an agreed interval of time. One may also detect the same feature in two distinctly Western literary creations, the novel and, still more, the theatre. Both of these involve the combined activities of a number of different individuals, in the novel in imagination, in the theatre in person, whose characters and interrelationships are seen to develop and change in the course of time. Such are the differences between the tale and the novel, the recitation and the theatre, and, one might perhaps add, the autocrat and the assembly. The same qualities may be seen in a more obvious form in the work of the historian, and indeed distinguishes his writing from that of the chronicler or analyst. All these involve some degree of harmonization by the novelist or playwright, the party leader or team captain, the composer and conductor. The same applies, perhaps with even greater force, to modern scientific research, which is no longer the preserve of the lone genius, but has come to rely increasingly on teamwork and organization. Modern science has extended our capacity to observe and to measure both time and space to a previously inconceivable degree, extending the scale from the nanosecond to the light year. Polyphony, in whatever form, requires exact synchronization. The ability to synchronize, to match times exactly, and for this purpose to measure times exactly, is an essential feature of modernity, and therefore a requirement of modernization. The precise measurement of passing time is, of course, a prerequisite of modern science and technology, both scientific research and working technology. It is also an essential characteristic, so obvious as usually to be taken for granted, of both private and public life in a modern society. The timetable, the tabulation of a sequence of events taking place at predetermined intervals, defined and demarcated with meticulous exactitude, is basic. In many ways, the least dramatic and most powerful instrument of change in the whole process of modernization, it seems to have begun with the railway, the earliest form of organized public transport covering fixed distances at fixed times and available to all who buy a ticket. The railway was followed by numerous other forms of public transport, covering ever greater distances at ever greater speeds. Before long, the Western world was crisscrossed by such lines of communication, and the timetable, indicating times of departure and arrival, became a feature of everyday life. The railway brought the timetable to the Middle East, and was followed by all the other modalities of modern transport, and hence of modern life. Today, the whole apparatus of modern communication, from telegraph through telephone to television, with more recent additions such as fax and internet, is at the disposal of Middle Eastern governments, and increasingly, of those who oppose and seek to overthrow them. Without timetables of one sort or another, neither society nor the economy could function, and the state would rapidly decline through confusion to chaos. Even such essential features of modern life as parades and demonstrations, political parties and business corporations, school curricula and the armed forces at all levels, from vast armies to simple infantry platoons, would be impossible. The modern history of the Middle East, according to a convention accepted by most historians of the region, begins in 1798, when the French Revolution, in the persons of General Napoleon Bonaparte and his expedition, arrived in Egypt, and for the first time subjected one of the heartlands of Islam to the rule of a Western power and the direct impact of Western attitudes and ideas. Interestingly, this aspect of the French occupation was seen immediately in Istanbul, where the Sultan, as suzerain of Egypt, was much concerned about the seditious effect of these ideas on his subjects. A proclamation was therefore prepared and distributed both in Turkish and in Arabic throughout the Ottoman lands, refuting the doctrines of revolutionary France. It begins, "In the name of God, the merciful and the compassionate, O you who believe in the oneness of God, community of Muslims, know that the French nation, may God devastate their dwellings and abase their banners, are rebellious infidels and dissident evildoers. They do not believe in the oneness of the Lord of heaven and earth, nor in the mission of the intercessor on the day of judgment, but have abandoned all religions and denied the afterworld and its penalties. They do not believe in the day of resurrection and pretend that only the passage of time destroys us, and that beyond this there is no resurrection and no reckoning, no examination and no retribution, no question and no answer." The passage of time is an allusion to the Quran, 45:23-24, which reads, "They, the unbelievers, say, there is nothing in our life but this world. We die and we live, and only time destroys us. Of this they have no knowledge, they only guess." The word translated time is the Arabic dar, one of many different Arabic words for time. It is usually used in the sense of passage or often duration of time. The term daria, followers of dar, is the classical term used by Muslim theologians for materialism in its various forms. There is indeed an extensive philosophical and theological literature discussing the nature of time. Such discussions are of little relevance at the present day. The clock and the timetable, the calendar and the program, these are the instruments by which modernity, itself a new and modern concept, is being introduced. By now, the whole world, including the Middle East, has so thoroughly accepted them that they are no longer recognized as of Western origin. The transformation of life through the introduction of the 24-hour day and of devices to monitor and even to plan its passing is enormous. In addition to timetables, it has made possible such things as schedules, agendas, programs, intervals, recesses, and, perhaps most difficult of all to assimilate, the making and keeping of appointments. The last word on this may be left to a distinguished French writer who toured the Middle East in 1947. "I have made, and I still make, the most sincere efforts during my travels in the East to arrive late at the appointments which they were kind enough to give me, and the time of which was always carefully discussed and finally agreed. I must admit that these virtuous attempts remain unsuccessful." Wise and experienced men sometimes said to me, "Here the sky is too blue, the sun too hot. Why hurry? Why do injury to the sweetness of living? Here everybody is late. The only thing is to join them. He who arrives at the appointed hour risks wasting his time, and that, after all, is not funny. Therefore, not too much precision. Strict exactitude has minor advantages, but is very inconvenient. It lacks suppleness. It lacks fantasy. It lacks cheerfulness, even dignity." Chapter 7. Aspects of Cultural Change. In about 1830, a young British naval officer called Adolphus Slade was dining with friends on the shore of the Bosphorus, and was rather surprised to hear the strains of a military band playing Rossini, coming from the direction of the Topkapi Palace. His interest aroused, he undertook some inquiries and made an interesting discovery. The band was formed, trained, and conducted by, as he said in the language of the time, a Sardinian. This alien presence in the palace was not as startling as might at first appear. The Sultan at the time, Mahmud II, was engaged in a large-scale reform of the Ottoman armed forces, a necessity in order to survive in the modern world. The army was being reorganized, re-equipped, more particularly, rearmed. But that was not all. In addition to their new weaponry, the Sultan provided his new-style army with Western-type uniforms and even with a brass band. Music, including military music, was of course old established, and Islamic civilization has a rich musical tradition of its own. Military bands are attested in the High Middle Ages and figure prominently in the armies of the Ottoman Empire, both on parade and in battle. They consisted of drums and trumpets, sometimes in large numbers. By the 18th century, the Turkish military music had become known in Europe and even inspired some notable European imitations. But along with his new weapons and his new uniforms, Sultan Mahmud felt it appropriate to introduce new music. In all his reforms, he sought help from abroad, from the Prussians for the army, from the British for the navy, from the French for the bureaucracy. In the same spirit, he asked the Sardinian embassy in Istanbul to provide a bandmaster to train and conduct, or should one say command, his brass band. In due course, a bandmaster arrived. His name was Donizetti, Giuseppe Donizetti, the brother of the more famous Gaetano Donizetti, the composer. Signor Donizetti set to work and formed what was officially designated as the Musiki I Humayun I Osmani, the Imperial Ottoman Music, a military band in the Western style, playing Western instruments and, of course, Western music. This was different from all the other reforms, or at least from most of the other reforms. The primary purpose of the modernization was military. Defeat had made it clear, even to the most conservatively reluctant, that something was wrong and needed to be put right, and the Sultan and his advisers set to work to create a new army. This meant, of course, a new officer corps, with new training and new weapons, and the infrastructure that was needed to support, train, equip, and move this army. All these were military choices, inevitably leading to political, economic, and social choices. They did not in themselves require cultural change. One could perhaps describe the introduction of Western-style uniforms as a cultural choice. The Sultan had to re-equip and reorganize his army, but he didn't have to dress them in slacks and tunics and Sam Brown belts. But this had, one might argue, a military, perhaps a disciplinary usefulness. A band playing Rossini, in contrast, is an unequivocally cultural choice. It is also the point where we can unhesitatingly speak of westernization rather than modernization, two terms the content and meaning of which have been the subject of much argument. Cultural change is westernization, part of modernization, no doubt, but not, according to a widely held view, an essential part of it. It was possible, according to this view, to modernize without westernizing. It was possible to have a modern army without Signor Donizetti and his brass band, to accept the weaponry and gadgetry of the West without being infected by its pernicious and corrupting culture. It didn't seem to take very well, this musical westernization. If one looks back to earlier times, there is practically no trace of any European cultural influence in the area of music, in spite of many centuries of contact between the Middle Eastern and Western worlds. We have a few, mostly negative, comments from Muslim visitors to Europe. One of the earliest comes from the 10th century. A certain envoy from Muslim Spain, Ibrahim ibn Yaqub, speaks of singing, which he heard in Schleswig. He describes it as a quite horrible sound, resembling the barking of dogs, but more beast-like. We have occasional references by other visitors, most of them diplomats. Who else would have taken the trouble to visit Europe? Some of them make fleeting references to European musical performances, the Vienna Boys Choir, the Paris Opera, but their comments relate to the spectacle and to the audience rather than to the actual music. There wasn't then much of a past for Signor Donizetti's brass band. What sort of a future did it have? Donizetti remained in Turkey, and we hear of him from time to time. He was, of course, given an officer's commission in the Ottoman forces. For a bandmaster, that was necessary. Later, he was promoted to Mirale, brigadier general, and eventually, by a later sultan, made a pasha. Donizetti Pasha still appears from time to time in the records, and at the end of the century, we hear of him by this time no doubt an old man, conducting an orchestra of harem ladies, escorted by eunuchs, for the entertainment of the Sultan. He started, apparently, with quartets and quintets, and then, with their help, developed an orchestra in the palace. We hear some occasional references to Western music. During World War I, Turkey's German and Austrian allies brought musicians to perform, presumably for their own people there, but some performances were also given for Turkish Muslim audiences in or near the palace. Generally, the reception of Western music in the Middle East has been remarkably limited. To this very day, the Middle East, with the exception of some westernized enclaves, remains a blank on the itinerary of the great international virtuosos as they go on their world tours. They go to Western and Eastern Europe, to North and South America, and now increasingly to South Asia and the Far East. Western art music is now listened to, performed, and composed in Japan, in China, and in India. It remains profoundly alien in most of the Middle East. The visual impact is incomparably greater. Anyone who has been to Istanbul must at one time or another have visited the Great Bazaar. In the courtyard of the entrance to the bazaar there is a mosque, the Nurosmaniye Mosque, completed in 1755. It is an Ottoman imperial mosque in the grand tradition, a single dome over a wide lateral extension of space, at first sight much resembling its predecessors, the great mosques of Sultans Mehmed, Suleiman, Selim, and the rest. But there is one rather interesting difference, and that is the Italian Baroque exterior decoration. When a foreign influence appears in something as central to a culture as an imperial foundation and a cathedral mosque, there is clearly some faltering of cultural self-confidence. Something is happening, something important. If we compare the cultural changes in music and in art, we must be struck by the fact that the second is far older, goes on for far longer, and is in every way more successful. A prized possession of the National Gallery in London is a portrait of the Ottoman Sultan Mehmed II, the conqueror of Constantinople, by the Italian artist Gentile Bellini. The painting is in London, not in Istanbul, because Sultan Mehmed's successor, the more pious Bayazid, disapproved of portraits and disposed of his father's collection. But Mehmed the Conqueror was neither the first nor the last Muslim ruler to indulge himself in this way. The Mamluk Sultan, Kait Bey, is reported to have had his portrait painted by a European artist. Later, it became quite usual among Middle Eastern monarchs to bring in Western, mostly Italian, artists. In time, we find local artists, sometimes trained in Europe, painting portraits. Painting a portrait was obviously a new and radical departure in the cultural traditions of a region that has a very rich and distinctive artistic tradition of its own. Donizetti, it would seem, was the first to try and introduce Western music. The Italian artist who helped build the Nurosmaniye Mosque more than half a century earlier was not by any means the first. He and his employers had already some experience on which to build. Western influences can be seen at quite an early date, even as far east as Iran, where miniature art shows awareness of European ideas and practices. Architectural influence becomes very clear both in the structure and in the interior decoration of buildings. By the 19th century, it is almost universal. The older artistic and architectural traditions were dying and being replaced by this new art from Europe. Visual westernization can be seen in a number of other ways. We see it, for example, in practical matters, coins and postage stamps. There had been coins in the Middle East for a very long time. Now they looked different. European usage in the form of royal portraits, an outrage according to traditional Muslim ideas, shows the degree of cultural penetration. Stamps were, of course, entirely new. The stamp was in itself a Western innovation, but still more so the form of the stamp, whom it portrays, what it depicts. One of the attractions of European art, and especially of portraiture, must have been a kind of realism and accuracy, very different from the formal stylized art of the traditional miniature. Portraits that were realistic likenesses had an obvious attraction. Before very long, they also proved useful for monarchs and others who could afford to pay for them, and knew how to use them. The same attraction explains the rapid acceptance and widespread use of photography, again in spite of the Muslim ban on human images. Clothes also show the influence of Western visual conceptions. Clothes, of course, serve a double purpose. On the one hand, to keep out the cold and the damp. On the other, as a recognition signal to indicate identity. When people change the clothes that they wear and adopt the clothes of another society, this represents a significant cultural choice and was both adopted and resisted as such. The clothing reform began with the armies, almost all of which now wear uniforms of Western pattern. Even the armies of Libya and the Islamic Republic of Iran still wear Western-type uniforms, just as they use Western-type weapons. Weapons are a military necessity. Uniforms are, at least in some degree, a cultural choice. One might almost say a cultural submission. Shoes and hats are particularly important. Shoes were seen by many Western travelers in the 18th and 19th centuries as one of the key distinctions between Middle Eastern and Western habits. When somebody is being Westernized, or, in Middle Eastern terms, is becoming Frankish in his habits, the wearing of leather shoes or boots acquires an almost emblematic quality. The supreme emblem is, of course, the headgear, which can indicate religion, allegiance, and sometimes occupation, and crowns the wearer even in death, as the carved headstones in an old-style cemetery attest. In many ways, the most important vehicle of cultural influence is, of course, the word, language, and more particularly, translation. The three major cultural groups in the Middle East, the users of Arabic, Persian, and Turkish, had a vast and rich literature at their disposal in all three languages. The rise of Western power was followed at first very tentatively and in a very exploratory way by the beginnings of translation of Western books. It is interesting and instructive to compare the modern translation movement of European books, which we may date from its small beginnings in the 16th century, with its medieval precursor, the great movement of translation from Greek, and to a lesser extent from Persian, into classical Arabic in the Middle Ages. In the medieval movement, the criterion of choice was usefulness. They translated what was useful, that is to say, primarily.